Here we are, Book of Romans. The idea of grace in the Book of Romans, that's what we're looking at. We've ordered some more workbooks, if you need workbooks, and they're back there on the little lectern there. Just grab one if you need one of those. And, of course, those of you who are watching from home, we have a lot of folks watching the class from home. You can always order those. Go on BibleTalk.tv, and you can order those workbooks for the Book of Romans, and follow along at home as you participate in this class. All right, so we're Romans 1, chapter 1, verse 1 to Romans 3. A little bit of review just to kind of, you know, get back into it. So we've said so far that God's original expression of grace is the creation itself and man's position at the head of creation and his participation in the divine nature and his intimate contact with God. Remember, grace is not a commodity. Grace is an attitude of God, his part of his character. And because he is in that way, because of his grace, because of his gracious character, he's created the world, he's put mankind at the head of it, he's created man in his own image, he's allowed man to have an intimate relationship with him. All these things have taken place because God is gracious. And then we talked about the initial fall from grace. That came when man disobeyed God, and in doing so, clouded his own nature. He undermined his position at the head of creation, and he rendered himself unable to directly communicate with God. The beautiful thing in the garden is that man was communicating directly with God. There was no intermediary. But after the fall, there were always, you know, necessary to have intermediaries. Prophets and different individuals would speak on God's behalf. God did not no longer speak to man directly, and nor did man speak to God directly in that situation. And then in Romans chapter 1, Paul describes the process of the fall from a macrocosmic view. In other words, a big picture. The fall of mankind from a big picture, if you remember. The process of the fall. So it begins as a theological fall. Man refuses to acknowledge God as God. Man refuses to give thanks to God. That's the beginning of the theological fall. The next stage is the philosophical fall. Man begins to worship something other than God. And he tries to explain life without reference to God. All these philosophies that try to explain what life is all about and, you know, what it means and so on and so forth with no reference to God. Well, that's part of the fall. And then the third part of the fall, we talked about that cycle, is the moral fall. Man plunges deeply into active evil and evil conduct. Now, one thing I didn't mention last week is that God's renewed expressions of grace throughout history have always centered around the promise of Christ to come. You know, we say there's the fall. Remember, we talked about the cycle, you know, theological fall, philosophical fall, moral fall, and then a renewal. God renews his grace towards man. And the renewal of God's grace has never been, I'm going to fix the world. That's never the thing that God said. I'm going to fix the world. I'm going to fix all the problems in the world. No. The renewal of God's grace is always seen as the offer of a Messiah in the future. That's been God's renewal of grace. Christ to come. So from the garden to the cross, it was the hope of his first coming that prophets continually stirred the people with. And then from the cross until the end of the world, it is the promise of his return that the church receives and uses to revive men's hearts with. When we get to the bottom of the moral curve, who's going to give that message? The philosophers, they come up with all kinds of solutions for the fall of mankind and the bad way we are in and the trouble that we're in and the wars and the lowering of standards and they got all kinds of plans and only the church has the true answer. And what is that? Jesus has come to forgive our sins and will return to take us to heaven. That's always the promise. And it's been that promise from, 2,000 years ago. The church was proclaiming Christ and saying one day Christ will return and, this earth will be done away with and we'll be with God once again, communicating directly with him, not having a body of sin anymore, and so on and so forth. That's always been the message of the church. 2,000 years, not different today. Same message today that we have to give to a fallen world. No matter where it is on the curve, no matter where it is on the cycle, the church always has the very same message. I often say, wow, what happens if Russia wins the war and takes over and the Chinese, come and invade America and, they toss out the president and, we have a Chinese premier and Chinese soldiers in the streets controlling everything. What are we going to do? I don't know what you're going to do, but I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to continue preaching the gospel in some manner, and I'm going to continue meeting with the saints when I can. I'm going to continue doing that. I'm going to continue to rely on God to provide for me one way or another. It doesn't change what I'm going to do. It's going to change how difficult it is, but it's not going to change what I'm going to do. Okay? So, in Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about man's moral failures and the kinds of things that moral failure has led mankind, In chapters 2 and 3, he's going to describe God's judgment and how this applies to individuals. The people would, Jesus would teach and the people would say, that's a hard teaching. Or the apostles would say, that's a hard teaching. Or the disciples, it says the disciples would say, that's a hard teaching. And it would say, and many of them did not follow him after that. Jesus gave hard teachings at times. So Romans chapter 2, this is a hard teaching. Okay? So in chapter 2, Paul summarizes how God will judge every single person that ever lived. Everybody. Paul does this by first of all dividing the world into two parts. And the two parts are very simple. Is this five? Is this slide five, Hal? Four? Slide four? There we go. Slide five. Thank you. Here's the standard of judgment. Divides the world into two parts. Jews, all the legitimate descendants of Abraham. Those are the Jews. And then the other part of the world are Gentiles. Sometimes he calls them Greeks, but he doesn't mean Greeks, all the people that come from Athens, Greeks mean, if you're not a Jew, you're a Greek or you're a Gentile, whichever. That's how he divides the world when it comes to talking about judgment. And he describes God's judgment in verses 5 to 16, and we're going to take the time to read that. Verses 5 to 7. It says, but because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. So introduction to the judgment of God. He says, who will render to each person according to his deeds, to those who by perseverance in doing good seek for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life. So, everyone who pursues good according to God's standard of what is good, and the law is what determines this, everyone who pursues good and does so in the understanding that they seek a life with God, that's what the honor and the glory and the immortality is all about. He's saying anybody that does what is good according to God's idea of what is good, those individuals will be saved. Now, the thing that he doesn't say is not a life according to what we think is good, but one lived according to what God thinks is good, and doing so consciously. Succeeding at this will save your soul. And he's saying both Jews and Gentiles who do this will be saved. All right, so hold that thought. He's going to develop that thought in verse 8. He says, but to those who are selfishly ambitious and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, wrath, and indignation. So those who do not obey the truth, remember, the truth that God is the one who determines what truth is, not your truth, these will be subject to God's exercise of angry punishment. So there it is. Salvation to those who pursue the truth, God's truth, and do so sincerely, and knowing that this is what they're doing, they'll be saved. And those who don't do this, they will be condemned. He continues in this line of thinking. Right. He says, there will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Greek. So remember, in context, he's talking about judgment. And he's talking about judgment that, you know, includes everybody. Because he's talking about Jews and Greeks. And he's saying God will judge every person according to this principle. Those who seek glory, who seek to obey God's truth, those people will be blessed. And those who don't will be cursed. And all will be judged alike, both Jew and Gentile. That's a pretty, you know, that includes everybody. No one escapes this. In other words, saying, I didn't know, nobody told me, nobody showed me the law. That excuse doesn't work. In 12 and 13... or 10, 11, 12, and 13, he says, but glory and honor and peace to everyone who does good, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For there is no partiality with God. Do you understand what he's saying? He's talking about judgment, and he's talking about how God is going to judge the Jews, and how God is going to judge the Gentiles. And it's the same judgment. All right, well, hang on. In verse 12, he says, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. Who is he talking about here? Who? I can't hear you. Who do you think he's talking about? He's talking about everyone. He's not talking just about Jews. He's talking about everybody. He says those who have sinned without the law. Well, those are the Gentiles. They're going to perish without the law. And then he says, and those who have sinned under the law, meaning the ones who know God's law, the Jews, will be judged by the law. And in both instances, these two groups will be punished. So Gentiles who have not received the law of Moses are still responsible to the principle of law. The principle of law, which exists where? Where does the principle of law exist for the Gentile? I just didn't hear it. Yes, in their heart, in their conscience. That's where the principle of law exists, in their conscience, and also in the creation, which clearly reveals God's presence and his demands. This principle does not articulate and reveal God as clearly as the Jewish law does, but it does place some moral and ethical demands nevertheless. For example, without the law, without the written law, okay, you're a Gentile, you've never seen the written law, you've never seen the commandments and anything else, right? But you know intuitively that it is wrong to murder your parents. It is wrong to sneak into your neighbor's tent and take his gold. You know intuitively that's not okay. To take another man's wife, you know that's wrong. You just know it intuitively. We're wired that way. We have a conscience that tells us, Little kids, right? Very little children who they've not been exposed, you know, to the quote, to the law and so on and so forth. And they'll try something and they'll go and they'll look around if mom's watching or something, because they know they're heading into land, you know, whether it's taking some cookies before supper. They kind of know they ought not to be doing that. And that idea becomes more sophisticated and sharper as we grow, as we grow older. So the Jews were clearly under the law of Moses, and they're going to be judged according to this law, which doesn't contradict the principle of the law. I mean, the Mosaic law said, "Thou shalt not kill." It's clear. It comes from God. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not lie. You know, you know the law. It's articulated clearly for you. But even the Gentile knows this through conscience, through heart. Okay. The law merely amplified, clarified what the heart already knew. So Paul explains that the judgment is based not on the sophistication and the clarity of the rule that we have. Whoops. There we go. I'll say that again. Paul explains that the judgment is based not on the sophistication and clarity of the rules that we have. In other words, you know, the principles that are revealed to us by God. The judgment is based on how people respond to the degree of law that they have. So the Jews had a very high degree, a very sophisticated understanding of God's law. I mean, he gave it to them. He wrote it down with his own finger, you know, not only the Ten Commandments, but all of the things that went along with the law, the explanation, you know, the peeling of the onion, right down to why this was not correct, and, you know, and so on. We talked about that in Leviticus. The Jew knew all of this. The Gentile had no idea of that. The Gentile had a lower bar. The Jew had a very high bar. The Gentile had a very low bar. But Paul is saying, if you lived up to the bar that you had, then you'll be saved. You'll be fine. Okay? All right. So in verses 14 to 16, I've mentioned that. There we go. So he says, "For when the Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, These, not having the law, are a law unto themselves. So the Gentiles, they have a bar, they have a law. It may not be as high bar as the Jews have, but it's a bar. They've got something to live up to. They have a measure by which God will measure them. That's what he's saying. In that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. He's talking about Gentiles here. He's talking about how their conscience says, yeah, you're doing a good thing. You know, you're helping a poor guy, or you're having mercy on someone. You know, you're feeling good about that. And you're refraining from the temptation of stealing something from your brother or something that's easy to steal. You're refraining from stealing. Why? Because you kind of know that that's not a good thing to do. They know in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, you know, this is right and this is wrong. Their thoughts alternately accusing, you did wrong, you shouldn't have done that, or defending them, way to go, you did a good thing. On the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Jesus Christ. He's saying this is going to be the bar of judgment when the judgment comes for the Gentiles. The Jews call them the Gentiles. Who do we call them? We call them the unbelievers. Same people. So think about that just for a second. So Paul explains how and why Gentiles are subject to both salvation and condemnation by demonstrating that what saves them or condemns them is their response to the principle of law directed through conscience and nature under which they live. He says that when they obey their law, they are righteous, just as when the Jews obey the Mosaic law, they are righteous. Now, in verses 17 to 29, don't have time to read all of that here, but in the final verses, he explains that the things that make a person pleasing to God are not the externals of religion or the level of religious sophistication that one aspires to. Now, Jewish law revealed God more exactly than the mere principle of law. However, how a person responded to the law that he lived under, that was the basis under which God would judge them. Because the Gentiles, they didn't have any sacrifices to offer. They didn't have the Sabbath. They didn't have, purification rites. They didn't have giving to God, a portion. They didn't have anything, none of that. And Paul is saying here, that doesn't matter for the Gentile. God will judge them based on the bar, you know, that they have. Now, in chapter 3, Paul describes how well the Jews and the Gentiles have responded to the systems of law under which they lived. Okay? So we go to chapter 3 and we read verses 1 to 8. It says, then, what advantage has the Jew? We should have been asking ourselves this too while I'm talking about this. So what's the big deal? Why become a Jew? I mean, if you have to live up to the low bar of the Gentile, why become a Jew and have to live up to the high bar? You know, what advantage, it says here, has the Jew? Or what is the benefit of circumcision? And then he answers his own question. He says, great in every respect. It's a good thing to be a Jew. It's a good thing to have that high bar, he said. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. What then? If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? May it never be. Rather, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in human terms. May it never be, for otherwise, how will God judge the world? But if through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come? Their condemnation is just. Wow, this is a mind bender, isn't it? These first eight verses here. So Paul begins chapter 3 by explaining that although the Jews had a true advantage in a greater clarity of God's will in the law of Moses, and it was meant to be an advantage, the Jews did not respond with righteousness to it. The only thing their advantage produced was to show how good God was. You know, you look at the history of the Jews, right? I mean, just at Paul's point, he could look back over Jewish history and he saw the history of the Jews. Well, what was the history of the Jews? God blesses them. They fall away, theological fall. They start worshiping other gods. They start making up another lifestyle. They fall into moral evil. In other words, they begin practicing all the detestable things that the pagans were doing, right? Offering their children to Molech and all that kind of stuff, you know. And then, whoops, somebody among them would cry out to God and say, God, please help us, you know. And God would send somebody, you know, Samson, Deborah, somebody. He would send a judge or somebody to help them. And whoops, and then there'd be a revival. They'd burn all the pagan altars. They'd cut down the poles, you know, all that stuff. And they'd make a commitment to be faithful to God again. And there was rejoicing. The temple was open and let's go. It's great. Everything is great. You know, we're at the top of the cycle. And then, whoops, and then another king, you know, it's always the same. Another king. He was not a good king. And what happened? Bingo, we start going down again. And when you realize, you know, this bad king, he would, you know, he reigned for 52 years. Imagine having the present administration for 52 years, or any administration for 52 years. And it says from the beginning, he wasn't good. He didn't do what God wanted. And so, bingo, here we go down again. So Paul is saying, the history of the Jews demonstrates how good God is. He kept forgiving them. He kept blessing them. He kept renewing them. He kept taking them back all the time. Okay? So some were saying that, well, if God was glorified by the revelation of the law and his dealing with disobedient Jews, then why does God condemn them? And their point was, after all, he is being glorified, isn't he? He got what he wanted. God received some glory. Why condemn the Jews? He's been demonstrated to be a glorious and gracious God throughout history. So why punish the Jews for that? God is getting what he wants. Whew. And so Paul responds that that kind of thinking says that evil somehow glorifies God and is somehow okay. And those who are warped enough to think this way, they deserve to be condemned. In other words, the people who were saying this were accusing God of, the end justifies the means. You know, God's being glorified because the Jews are always sinning and he has to renew them and show them grace. Well, God's being glorified. You know, who cares? That's what's important, isn't it? No, that's not what's important. That's not what this is for. So he's kind of, you know, responding to a side argument here while he's talking about judgment in general. So in verses 9 to 18, he summarizes the universal condemnation due to all men, one that was spoken of in the Old Testament and renewed in the New Testament here by Paul. And he says in verse 9, "What then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. Both groups," he says, "have failed to live up to the standard of law under which they stood, and so are therefore condemned." So, they're condemned not because they, the Gentiles, didn't become Jews, or because they don't know about Christ, but because of what they did. God doesn't condemn us because of what we don't know or don't do, but rather for what we do do. So the Gentiles had a lower bar, to reach. And Paul is saying they didn't even reach the low bar. Never mind the high bar, they didn't reach the low bar. And then in verses 10 to 12, he says, "As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one." So the Holy Spirit, using the words of David, penned centuries before, declares that God, knowing every single heart, judges that none of them seek him. None of them desire honor or goodness and eternal life. No matter what the outside look like, God tells us that this is the condition of the heart. Whether they were aiming at a low bar or a high bar, nobody, he says, no one reached the level that he had given them. None were searching for him. According to this passage, there is no such thing as the noble savage. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression before, the noble savage. Noble savage, for example, a Chinese person living in the 4th century. How is that person, why is that person condemned? That person could not have come in contact with the gospel. There was no gospel in China in the 4th century. What happens to that guy? Paul here is saying that person will be condemned also. And we say, well, why? That doesn't sound fair. And the reason is he could know God through the witness of his own conscience and nature. Romans 1:19. However, he did not respond to the principle of law under which he lived. Romans 3:23. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That word "all" there includes everyone. There are no exceptions here. And then the thing that comforts me personally, because I remember when I was a younger Christian, I struggled mightily with this idea. It just didn't seem fair. And then when I understood Romans, God assures us that he has examined every heart and none were seeking for him. In other words, how do we know that this is true? There's none righteous. No one is seeking after God. How do we know that? Is it just because Paul says so? Well, no. Paul is saying that God assures us. He's saying, don't worry. Don't feel bad. Don't feel some vicarious guilt because someone who, didn't hear the gospel way back there in history in the middle of Africa or Asia or South America or some tribe or something like that. Don't feel bad about that. you, Michael, you couldn't see inside their heart. You couldn't make a judgment. But me, God, I see into all the hearts. Don't worry about unfairness. Don't worry about justice. I've looked at every single heart, and I'm assuring you that not a single one is searching for God. We don't have to judge. God has already done so and recorded the results for us to see. Remember I said, this is a hard teaching? Well, this is a hard teaching. I mean, there's so many people that try to massage this to say it's something else, but it doesn't. It doesn't say something else. It says what it says. Now, what if someone says, what if someone was searching for him? What would happen? Well, in Hebrews 11:6, the answer is there. And without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Those who respond to God in conscience, in nature, how will they be found? Well, they'll be found by God. From Seth to the patriarchs to the nation of Israel and now the church, God has always had his people as a light to draw to him those who searched for him. In any age or in any place, if someone is looking for God, God will find them. That's a promise. I use myself as an example, not an extreme example like, you know, the Chinaman in the 4th century. But I lived in Montreal, Quebec, French Canada. Okay, I got time. Brought up in the Catholic Church, you know. In the summertime, you know, when our kids go to camp, I used to go, you know, I went to the monasteries when the seminarians were on vacation. You know, we went in as young guys, young teenagers, and we would clean and we would fix things up, and we kind of live the life of a monk for a couple of weeks to try that out. Augustinian Monastery in Vancouver, I was there for a couple of weeks. And back in Montreal, at a time when 90% of people who lived, 6 million people, 90% of them were Catholic. The prime minister was Catholic. The police chief was Catholic. The fire chief was Catholic. Every single business owner was Catholic. Every teacher was Catholic. Every school was Catholic. How do you find the gospel there in the middle of all of that? And old-style European Catholicism. And then one day, because I had said to myself, it can't be that the creator of the universe is using this religion to represent himself. I mean, I had come to that conclusion. But I didn't know anything else. There was nothing else. It was like, well, God, if you're out there somewhere, if you want me to find you, help me. And one day I opened the free paper you get in the mail there for from Kroger's or from whatever it is, Cheap and Easy or some grocery store, and they've got ads. It's free, right? But in the middle, sometimes they have ads, you know, like bicycles for sale, or somebody needs a guy to cut his grass or something like that, you know, little thing. And in the middle of that thing, there was a little one-column ad, and at the top it said, sinners are welcome at the Church of Christ. And a little article that talked about, if you're a sinner, you'll be in good company because you'll be welcome at the Church of Christ. And I looked at that ad and it just, you know, I was saying, well, that's talking to me. That's me. That's me. And I went. And sure enough, they welcomed me. You know, we talk about the greeters, how important it is. You know, yeah, they greeted me. I mean, it was a little church, 40 people. They greeted me. And you know the story. I've told it before. Caribbean lady, Miss Brown, Hemsey. You remember Hemsey? And she said, you come and sit by me. You know, and she showed me the songbook, and I didn't understand the communion. What? They pass it around. You don't go to the front. You get the bread and the wine, you know, in this funny little cup, you know. What's that all about? And she explained everything. And she gave me a hug. And she says, you'll come back. I said, yeah, maybe. And I went back. And, you know, the rest is your story. I studied with someone, and they taught me, and I was baptized, and so on and so forth. But in a sea of Catholicism, which had its positive things, but you know what I'm saying, it wasn't enough. It didn't ring true. I called out. God found me. So, to summarize this lesson in a minute or so. So all men have renounced grace and are caught in a cycle of theological, philosophical, and moral failure from generation to generation. All are condemned from Adam until the end of the world. There is no one that escapes condemnation. They can't do it because of ignorance. Because everybody has the knowledge of God one way or another through the principle of the law inherent in nature or conscience or through direct revelation. You know, they've got it one way or another. And innocence is not an excuse either. God has and does examine every heart and reveals to us in advance that no one searches for him. No one is innocent of sin. I can take that to the bank. I don't have to. It's not me saying that. God is saying that. So the conclusion is that all have renounced God's initial expression of grace and stand condemned for it. And unless we understand and accept the universality of condemnation, we cannot appreciate God's response of grace in sending Jesus. I mean, if condemnation is only partial, even one exception, then Jesus is only a partial savior, and Christianity is only one of many possible solutions. That's why our religion is losing its power today. It's not seen as the answer. It's seen as one of the answers. Well, if we're one of the answers, I've wasted 45 years of my life. If Christianity is just one of the answers, could have picked an easier road. And when we accept the universality of condemnation, the Great Commission takes on much more meaning. We have to go because people will perish without the gospel, and they will not try to find it themselves. We see why evangelism is the priority of the church and its main reason for existing. Don't begrudge the elders if they put in 20 or 30% of the budget to support mission work. That's what we're about. And finally, the universality of condemnation is a sobering thought that helps us appreciate our own salvation and those who have brought us to Christ, those who labor to keep us true. I appreciate what I have when I see how close I came to not finding it. When I see how close, you know, on the edge, looking into the abyss, when I remember, oh, I could have missed it. I'm so happy for the MacArthur Park Church of Christ in San Antonio, Texas, who sent Jim Metter to Montreal, Quebec, and he didn't speak French, to preach the gospel to 40 people in his church. I'm so thankful to them. And there are many in Haiti and Kenya, and in Zimbabwe for now, that are thankful to the Choctaw Church because we pay for a preacher to preach the gospel, not to mention Bible Talk that preaches to the whole world every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We preach to everyone in the world. That was my dream when I first started it. And we support that work. We work on that work. Okay, so like I said, hard lesson here. It's a hard thing. The comfort of it is that if someone's looking, God will find them, will send someone to them. All right, we're moving on to chapter 4 next week. Thank you for your attention.